listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Crossing over. America's southern border is not only a crossing point for migrants from Mexico and the rest of Latin America. Photojournalist Go Nakamura captures desperate and determined souls from China to Chad, India to Morocco, caught in a no-man's land between the danger they fled and the paralyzed system that awaits them. Essay by Dara Lind. Opening photo, newcomers from Africa and Latin America walk toward the staging area in Lukeville to be transported by the Border Patrol on the same day. This is what abandonment looks like. First abandoned by the hope of making a life in their home countries, compelling them to flee. Then left behind by smugglers, who could successfully get them to the United States alive, but whose responsibility for their survival ends abruptly in the desert. Finally, waiting to present themselves to federal agents to start, they hope, the next phase of their lives. Many newcomers find that processing is at capacity. They are stranded before being formally apprehended. Photojournalist Go Nakamura witnessed desperation and determination in the border deserts of California and Arizona during reporting trips in November, December, and April, and captured how the U.S.-Mexico border has become one side of an ongoing global crisis. The UN's refugee agency estimates that nearly 40 million refugees and asylum seekers were displaced from their home countries as of April, which would break records set since the organization's founding in 1950. While most of these people are living in refugee camps or on the margins of society in countries that are often struggling themselves, an increasing number are seeking a new life in America. 20 years ago, the typical person crossing the U.S.-Mexico border illegally, the one federal border policy was designed to catch, was a Mexican adult, traveling alone to find under-the-table work. But after the Great Recession, the demographics shifted. More Central Americans, more families, often seeking out border agents to ask for asylum. And in the last half decade, with new smuggling routes and lightning-fast social media word of mouth, it has shifted again. In 2023, the majority of people apprehended by U.S. Border Patrol came from countries other than Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Nakamura's subjects hail from Brazil, Colombia, Peru, and Venezuela, part of a broader trend of South American border crossings, given the instability in the region over the last decade. But the people Nakamura met are also from China, India, Turkey, Chad, and Morocco. Some flew into South American airports, then traveled northward to the Isthmus of Panama, crossing on foot through the dangerous jungle, a place known as the Darien Gap, because it was generally regarded as impassable before migrants started passing through it in large numbers. From there, they continued up to Mexico, a journey that often takes months and carries the constant risk of violence at the hands of smugglers or governments. These vivid photos depict the moment when the odyssey has seemingly ended, when people have finally arrived in the United States. What greets them? Nothing. The U.S. government's approach toward border crossings under both parties has been deterrence, trying to prevent people from coming. This strategy has included physical barriers, like fencing or a border wall, in places where it's easier to cross on foot or by car, leaving the remote desert as the best remaining option. Those who aren't deterred are simply endangered. According to U.S. statistics, nearly 900 bodies were discovered along the border in fiscal year 2022, when a cause of death could be determined. Exposure was the most common factor. In a way, asylum seekers are more vulnerable to the elements when they choose to wait for Border Patrol agents and turn themselves in. They are putting their well-being at the mercy of a system that has simply no capacity to accommodate them. Some of Nakamura's photos depict open-air camps that have sprung up as agents make people wait outside for days before they are formally caught. One woman Nakamura spoke to had been waiting for 6 days. She was so tired, he says, and kept asking, "When is the Border Patrol coming?" Another man he met gave up and left for San Diego on his own. Most of them wait, not just because they fear finding their own way in the desert, but because turning themselves into border agents is the essential first step toward the goal of attaining full legal status in the U.S. by receiving asylum. International agreements developed in the wake of the Holocaust prevent the U.S. from deporting someone to a country in which they are in danger of being persecuted based on their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Federal law sets the same grounds as the basis for claiming asylum, which, if granted, allows the asylee to apply for permanent legal resident status and, after several years, U.S. citizenship. While entering between official border crossings is illegal, it does not disqualify someone for asylum. The law specifically states that no matter how someone arrived on American soil, they have the right to ask the government for protection once here. This prevents the government from simply expelling asylum seekers without potentially running afoul of the law. Instead, it forces officials to process them, to assess whether they have the right to remain in the U.S., and in the meantime to hold them in custody or allow them to live in American communities. Few American citizens, much less border crossers, precisely understand asylum law. While that means plenty of people are put in the queue who don't have a strong asylum case, it also means others would qualify if they understood what was being asked. Some people come readily equipped with stories about relatives being threatened by their country's governing political party. Others may say at first they are here to make a living, only to reveal later they lost jobs at home because they opposed their government, which can also be the basis of an asylum claim. As more border crossers have presented themselves for asylum in recent years, the immigration courts assigned to hear their cases have gone from overwhelmed to utterly swamped. Most people will wait years before they get a chance to make their case. The federal government attempts to screen asylum claimants, deporting those who are less likely to qualify. And the Biden administration has attempted to tighten this screening, but there are only enough asylum officers to interview a small fraction of asylum seekers. Next photo, a group waiting to be transported by the U.S. Border Patrol in Lukeville, Arizona, on December 12, 2023. Some of Nakamura's subjects were no doubt deported without an asylum hearing, as tens of thousands of people are each month. But most were likely assigned a court date and released from federal custody, given overcrowding at border facilities and a lack of officers to screen their claims. In this new era, border crossers from far-flung countries may not already have relatives or acquaintances in the U.S. who can host and support them. In general, asylum seekers cannot work legally until months after they have filed a formal application with the court. They may only decide where to go based on word of mouth, exacerbating the glut of new arrivals in cities such as Chicago and New York. The Biden administration, like its predecessors, keeps trying to crack down on those arriving now in hopes of bringing crossing levels down in the future. In June, it instituted an emergency border regime that considerably raises the bar for people seeking protection until crossings fall substantially or the federal courts intervene. But a decade of evidence shows that even the most dramatic crackdown works for only a few months as people wait to learn how to get in under the new regime. The president can declare that the border is closed, but that doesn't create a force field in the Arizona desert. Turning those statements into reality runs into the limits of resources, agents, space, and money, and the legal prohibition on deporting people to face persecution. Meanwhile, smugglers respond to every shift in policy, changing locations, timing, and methods. If they cannot drop people off at the border, they can lock them in U.S.-bound tractor trailers. At the moment, they cross into the United States. Nakamura subjects are not under the control of either government or smuggler. They are in the no-man's land, in which no one is taking responsibility or authority over them. They are waiting for the United States to decide what exactly it wants to happen next, a question the country has hardly even asked itself. Next photos. A family stands in line to receive food distributed by local volunteers in Hocumba Hot Springs, California, on November 10, 2023. Asylum seekers from China walk the U.S. side of the border wall after crossing from Mexico in Hocumba Hot Springs. People from various African countries line up to board the Border Patrol van in Lukeville. A man from China moves around the border wall into California from Mexico. Arrivals from China built makeshift tents during their time, waiting to be transported by U.S. Border Patrol agents after crossing into the U.S. from Mexico. And an individual from Africa crosses the border wall through a gap into Lukeville. People from India and Colombia gather around a fire while waiting to be picked up by the U.S. Border Patrol on April 27, 2024. Thank you. suspicious minds. True crime enthusiasts are exactly what the name suggests. Rubberneckers in it for the gore, or prurience, or ick, some kind of thrill. But the attendees of CrimeCon suggest something a little deeper and scarier than any of that. By Kathleen Hale, with illustrations by Yvonne Guillot, looking like cartoons from true crime novels. On the weekend of September 22, 2023, 4,000 women, and some men too, descended on the Orlando World Center Marriott for the 6th annual CrimeCon, described by its founder, Kevin Balfa, as a place where victims can feel loved. Launched in 2017, CrimeCon brings together consumers and content creators within the true crime genre for presentations by criminology experts, law enforcement, victims, and niche celebrities such as renowned pedophile catcher Chris Hansen. The convention's attendance pales beside events like GamesCon, around 320,000 participants, and comic conventions, more than 126,000 at L.A. Comic-Con alone, but distinguishes itself by its overwhelmingly female spectatorship. Balfa estimates that 80% of its attendees are women. CrimeCon Orlando kicked off in the Grand Ballroom with a neon-themed rock concert by The Sole Purpose, featuring guitarist Creighton Waters, otherwise known as the prosecuting attorney in the Alex Murdoch trial. The band played covers of Peaceful Easy Feeling by the Eagles and Whiskey Glasses by Morgan Wallen, while in a roped-off VIP area, women posed in police caps and other props at a complimentary photo booth. Nearby, two adult sisters danced with their elderly mother, who had warned them since birth about bad men. And perhaps that's why they were here tonight, still alive. Later, the dance floor and cocktail tables would be replaced by enough chairs to accommodate thousands more true crime fans. But for now, LED glasses and headbands shaped like Playboy bunny ears flashed in the dark, as women in sequins and feather boas shimmied to a bracing cover of Shamalama Ding Dong. "We literally marinate in true crime all day," shouted an Orlando-based massage therapist, raising her voice to be heard over I'm Every Woman. She and a longtime client had embarked on a girls' trip to CrimeCon and fondly recalled how they'd been talking about murder since their very first bodywork session. "We bonded from that." Over the intervening years, the two had started playing true crime podcasts and documentaries during massages. Now they describe themselves as best friends in true crime. "Excuse me," intoned a low voice, and I looked up to see a bearded man wielding a beanbag. Apparently, I was blocking his neon cornhole game, an actual thing that was happening. Because, yes, there were men at CrimeCon, though my conversations with them gave the impression that they'd come under duress. One described his female companion's true crime obsession as very weird. Another would find himself so nauseated by the weekend's proceedings that he left the conference while his wife stayed behind, riveted and unburdened. Even CrimeCon speaker Paul Holes, the handsome former investigator famous for his role in catching the Golden State Killer, now a niche celebrity among true crime junkies who lust after the troubled male detective archetype, had, in a certain way, come at the behest of women. He, too, would feel overwhelmed that weekend, not just by traumatic memories of old cases, which simmered to the surface during his CrimeCon presentations, necessitating a CrimeCon-branded mug of bourbon, which Holes carried with him on stage, or during the simple and necessary act of sleep, necessitating more bourbon. Blacking out was a respite from the nightmares, including a recurring one of a victim's face, caved in and hatching flies, but also by the masses of women who hindered his movements and touched him during selfies. When asked what brought you here, one man at the Sole Purpose concert, Shane, 50s, answered plainly, "My wife." He and Tammy, couple's name, Shammy, they told me twice, were discussing the gender disparity at CrimeCon when I arrived at their table. Shane attributed it to commercials, he said, presumably alluding to the Activia ads, or whatever, that air between segments of Dateline. When asked what she thought, Tammy hesitated, as if trying to formulate a response that would not discredit Shane's. Finally, she ventured, quietly with evident self-doubt, as if not wanting to offend her husband, "Well, I wonder if it's because a lot of the victims are women." As if on cue, two beautiful survivors of domestic violence, Natalia, 38, and Stacy, 43, danced through the ballroom's doorway in matching tie-dyed overalls. Like many other women that evening, they were twinning. Natalia and Stacy had connected 15 years earlier while living in Colorado, after Stacy spotted Natalia trudging through their shared apartment complex with a bottle of wine in each hand and quickly identified her as a kindred spirit. Later, during a blizzard, they watched the entire Casey Anthony trial together on Stacy's laptop while sorting jelly beans into personalized piles. Stacy loved red, Natalia preferred green, and they both liked blue, which they stacked in the middle. "Barbie," Natalia exclaimed, admiring a woman dressed like the doll. Stacy promised me that Natalia had strong opinions about ongoing cases. Both women believe that Brian Koberger, the former criminology student charged with murdering four college kids at the University of Idaho in 2022, is definitely guilty, in part because of the evidence against him, but also because, well, he just looked like one of those guys women instinctively avoid. "We have to deal with creeps 24/7, Natalia said, "even when we're children." After the concert ended, I returned to my hotel around 1 a.m. Heading to the elevators, I overheard newlyweds Kirsten, 31, and Molly, 32, debating the death penalty in the lobby. "The only way that it should be okay is in a lethal injection situation," argued Kirsten, a nanny with pink-streaked hair. "That's kind of moral. We do that to our dogs, you know what I mean?" Molly, a deadpan attorney, turned to me, "On the record, our dogs are alive." Kirsten rolled her eyes. "No, I'm just saying, when they're old." "We have two basset hounds. We love them. They're alive," Molly reiterated. Both were CrimeCon diehards, honeymooning at this year's convention after getting engaged at the previous one in Vegas. There, Molly had taken Kirsten to the Shark Reef Aquarium at Mandalay Bay, where a scuba diver swam over and pressed to the exhibit glass a laminated printout bearing clip art of two dolphins kissing and the proposal, "Kirsten, will you marry me?" As animal lovers, both wanted to wed at a zoo. But back home in Tennessee, the two ended up getting emergency married, as Kirsten put it, after Governor Bill Lee signed anti-drag legislation into law, which was later overturned. "It could be scary living down south," Molly conceded. She'd once been chased from a mall by a man screaming faggots. Upon reflection, Molly granted that being gay in America had scaffolded at least some of her interest in true crime, attributing the relatability of victimization to why a lot of women in general gravitate toward the genre. "It could happen to you, so you have to be aware and vigilant," she explained, describing the urge to study criminal cases as a means of self-defense. "Information is knowledge." For her part, Kirsten traced her own obsession with crime to the fact that her childhood babysitter had been murdered violently, kidnapped, tortured, raped, and stuffed in a trash can where she'd slowly suffocated. Kirsten sighed, summarizing the experience as, "Sad, really depressing, gonna F you up in the mind." At this, Molly shot Kirsten a lawyerly look, as if questioning the wisdom of saying the F-bomb in a Vanity Fair article. "I'm not a professional lady. I'll say whatever I want," Kirsten joked back. "You're a grown-up, and I'm..." She trailed off, seeming to realize then and there that she'd chosen the same career path as her murdered babysitter. I don't know that any woman has made it to being an adult without having some sort of traumatic experience, Kirsten concluded. I literally don't think it exists. The next day, presentation started at noon, but by 9 a.m., the World Center Marriott Convention Center was already packed. While some collected prizes from mock evidence lockers in the Oxygen TV lounge, mine an unflattering bucket hat in bumblebee colors, others queued to sit in massage chairs set before TVs playing Cold Justice, a true crime show about cold cases starring veteran prosecutor Kelly Siegler. Prosecuting Evil with Kelly Siegler dropped a month after CrimeCon. Siegler has spoken openly about witnessing domestic violence throughout her childhood. When she was a kid, her then-stepdad beat her mother. Yet it was Siegler's mom who found herself on the receiving end of police lectures. If you would learn how to shut your mouth, the cop said, you wouldn't get in trouble. Young Siegler had seethed. You're telling her that? Go arrest him. Go do something. But they didn't. And the injustice of that was one factor that later propelled Siegler into law school, followed by a successful career as a prosecutor. In court, she won 19 out of 20 death penalty cases, earning Siegler the nickname Giant Killer. In some cases, in special cases, not all the time and not that often, but sometimes, Siegler said of the death penalty, oh, it's justice. Later that day, a massive audience filled the main ballroom for a motivational talk by Kathy Kleiner Rubin, who recently published a memoir about triumphing over lupus, breast cancer, and one of the most infamous serial killers in history. A Light in the Dark, Surviving More Than Ted Bundy, co-written with Emily LeBeau-Lucchese, and it's very good. 45 years earlier, when Kleiner was just 20 years old, the serial killer had brained her with an oak log, the same wood species used to make the electric chair in which Bundy later burned. Inspirational music and videography hyped Kleiner's entrance. Coldplay's Viva La Vida blared over the speaker system as a screen above the stage beamed the words, Are you ready for the most emotional crime con yet? And with that, Kleiner, all 4 feet 11 inches of her, stepped on stage. She waited out the deafening applause before launching into it. This is my story. After escaping through the ceiling duct of a Colorado jail in 1977, Bundy crossed state lines and crept onto the Florida State University campus, slipping through the back door of the Chi Omega house to beat and strangle to death two sorority sisters. He raped one of them once she stopped breathing. Next, he entered 19-year-old Kleiner's bedroom. Kleiner, then an aspiring interior decorator, lay sleeping under a tree-patterned comforter, which she'd selected to match the bedroom's green carpeting. She woke to a silhouette looming over her. Suddenly, she was in searing pain, her tongue half-severed, jaw shattered, one cheek torn open. But before Bundy could kill her, car headlights swept across the bedroom window, prompting him to flee. In the ensuing melee of ambulance sirens and Bundy's criminal trial, young Kleiner found herself fixated on that precious blood-soaked bedspread, feeling sad that it was ruined. 45 years later, Kleiner's jaw still aches. I can't eat corn. She manages the pain with hot packs and cold packs, and every few years she endures yet another surgery. But what really helps, Kleiner says, is CrimeCon. I never had a therapist or anything, so just talking it out has been my therapy. She described the convention as a kind of wellness retreat for survivors, saying she'd met so many attendees in so many different stages of trauma. Kleiner wanted them to know that women can get through more than they think, even though it's painful, and they might still be living through it. So it's not just a past crime, it's a current crime. Of her own scars, courtesy of Bundy, Kleiner said, It's kind of you, you know, melting into who I am. Kleiner's sentiment would later be echoed by renowned serial killer expert Catherine Ramsland, Ph.D., a prolific author of 71 and counting books, who also happens to have once been Koberger's criminology professor. When asked during her CrimeCon presentation, Violent Minds, whether looking back at her life, any experiences stood out as having seeded an early interest in crime, Ramsland laughed in surprise. Nobody had ever asked her that before. "Well," she said, "when I was a kid, there was a serial killer operating in my hometown, and friends of my brother's found the first body." The crowd oohed and aahed, so I would have to say that probably established it. There were other ordeals, too, it turned out, like a great-grandfather who tried to poison the whole family, and a grandmother who was murdered. "So I have lots of things," Ramsland realized. After the presentation, she would elaborate to News Nation, "There's certainly violence in the background that has trickled down to me." As a scholar, Ramsland approaches true crime through a clinical lens, distinguishing her interest in the genre from its entertainment value. Like many of the women at CrimeCon, whose long list of safety precautions had partly been gleaned, they said, from crime stories, carrying mace, walking in groups, calling a friend to say where you're going, the subtext being that if you're abducted, people will know sooner, raising the statistical likelihood of finding you, or at least your corpse, Ramsland's conclusions on personal safety underscore the universal danger of being female. "When I walk past a male on the street, I will always watch over my shoulder. Always," Ramsland said to me in a follow-up interview, explaining that if somebody were to roll down their window and ask for directions, she would never approach the car, because I've known some of the strategies that offenders use to grab vulnerable people. "Which is not to say they could never get one over on me. Of course they could," she added. Still, Ramsland said she did what she could to avoid being killed by men like those she studied. "I have yet to take a ride share." I caught up with Natalia and Stacy later that evening at a bar off the Marriott lobby. The two were enjoying a long-awaited glass of wine. Earlier that day, to Stacy's irritation, Natalia had forgotten to bring along their water bottles, filled to the brim with Pinot Grigio, a misunderstanding they'd since settled. "We love each other to the moon and back," Natalia said, flashing her moonstone ring, a gift from Stacy. Stacy recounted how, as a kid, she used to drill pins for her dad outside the family's construction company in a field surrounded by men. When her dad noticed his male employees staring at her budding breast, he moved her to the front office, assigning her solitary administrative work instead. "Pay attention to what's going on around you," he warned. "I thought I was being punished," Stacy admitted. Yet she recalled with apparent fondness how the same men who had ogled her as a child suddenly became protective of her when other men did the same. She was describing the patriarchy's split personality, which simultaneously sexualizes and infantilizes women. The latter approach, when weighed against the alternative, being killed, begins to feel surprisingly comforting. "It does kind of suck," she admitted. "Like, yeah, maybe I didn't get strangled, but why do we have to wake up and think about that?" Like Stacy, Natalia worked in a male-dominated industry. Mixing in those circles had made her a little bit of a dick, she admitted, just to prevent men from taking advantage, a phenomenon, her tone implied, with which she had had ample experience. "I have understood your tribe. I hear your jokes. I smell your farts," she said of men, whom Natalia had learned to live without, choosing instead to snuggle with her pet turtles, Sexy Rexy and Ninja Turtle, which Stacy later cited, jokingly, as one reason that she and Natalia had not simply married one another. Just then, Stacy's husband, Amit, who was sitting at the bar, glued to a college football game, shouted at the TV, drunk and happy, "Shit, he's running!" Stacy recalled a joke she'd recently made to him. "And this is a terrible thing to say," she said. "But I joked one day." "Oh," her voice turned sad, tinged with theatrical realization, "I'm not rapeable anymore." It was something she remembered hearing on a show, where a woman was running through a parking lot and someone said, "You should be careful." Don't worry, the character responded. I'm too old for anyone to rape me. A sentence that, to Stacy, perfectly distilled what is arguably the most effed up layer of womanhood. After a certain age, the constant threat of rape fades, leaving in its wake a deafening silence. And pathetically, it's only then, once the constant catcalling and threats of violence wane, that the truly pathological part sets in. Suddenly deprived of all the little indignities that have soundtracked our lives, we miss them. The patriarchy leaves an indelible mark on us, and we hate it for that, even as we still crave its attention. It gets harder and harder being a woman, Natalia agreed. And then they turned to me, demanding to know why I seemed so interested in their pain, and whether I had any of my own. Of course I related to them. The first time a stranger slapped my ass, I was 12 years old. Over the intervening years, strange men pulled me onto their laps, called me a bitch, and stood in my way when I wanted to leave, among countless other formative experiences, including more overt forms of sexual violence that I don't care to list here, because I'd rather lose myself in other people's stories than relive my own. At this point, Amit sank into the booth, wanting me to know that, so far, he had not enjoyed a crime con. Pedophiles, rape, it's not for me, he said, sounding proud of himself. It's interesting, Stacy began carefully, hypothesizing that perhaps part of the reason she and Natalia gravitated toward crime stories was not necessarily because they loved rape and murder and pedophilia, but because being a woman leads to trauma. And exposing oneself to other people's traumas helps to make sense of one's own experiences, to contextualize them and to find community. For women, I think, especially when it comes to rape or sexual assault, I think we already kind of know about it, she ventured, instinctively adding a question mark to the end of her sentence to soften its blow, just like Tammy of Shammy had done. Amit interrupted her. Wait, 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 hold on. But said nothing else. I think that's why there might be way more women here than men, I offered. Yeah, I saw the line to the restroom, he joked back. By 5 p.m. that evening, crowds that had gathered 8 hours earlier showed no signs of thinning. One woman zoomed past me on her surgery scooter, pushing herself along with one good foot, unstoppable in her quest for more crime stories. Inside the grand ballroom, a huge audience awaited a presentation by the tenacious former prosecutor turned crime commentator Nancy Grace. Mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. Like so many women at CrimeCon, Grace was driven into this space by unthinkable trauma. When she was 19 years old, Grace's fiancé was murdered just before their wedding. A tragedy that catapulted Grace into a long, successful tenure as a special prosecutor in Atlanta, then known as the murder capital of America, after which came jobs at Court TV's Closing Arguments, 1997 to 2007, followed by other shows like Nancy Grace, 2005 to 2016, and years punctuated by a slew of books, TV appearances, public speeches, and a podcast. Grace's Crime Con presentations in particular are something to behold. Speeches doesn't quite capture the drama of her stagecraft, which feels more akin to performance art, good performance art, about a woman who effing hates crime. At each recitation, Grace weeps fresh tears into the microphone, reliving her fiancé's murder, bullet wound by bullet wound, his back, his neck, his face, with those beautiful blue eyes, conducting her grief into furious dissections of contemporary criminal cases, followed by adulations of joy over her many blessings. The process involves lots of yelling from Grace, known in part for her brash southern drawl, bellowing sometimes in anger. They saw their mommy's head blow up like a pumpkin, but also sometimes in joy. One of the happiest moments of my day is when I take the twins to school. Her eyes flash, her nose runs, the fringe on her leather blazer trembles with every emotional turn. The night before, Molly and Kirsten had warned me of Grace's intensity. The most memorable experience of CrimeCon last year for me was the unhinged quality of Nancy Grace's session, applauded Kirsten. She was out of her mind. Molly recalled how Grace had railed against illegal immigrants, prompting the women in her audience to rejoice, "God bless you, Nancy." It felt like I was at some weird Republican convention, Kirsten said, and Molly launched into an alarmingly accurate impersonation of Grace's accent, all sliding vowels and loud consonants, exclaiming, "Good Southern gentleman, good Southern girl, good Southern young man." When I observed that Grace might not be up on her gender studies, Molly quipped, "She's not up on anything." "But she is up on volume studies," wisecracked Kirsten, referring to Grace's voice and voluminous bleached blonde hair. While Kirsten considered Grace's messaging to be problematic, bordering on dangerous, she nevertheless conceded her support as a fellow woman. "I love that you're a lady and you're successful. I'm glad. I'm happy," she said of Grace. "The point is, she's just wild in the mind," Kirsten explained. But for Nancy Grace superfans, the unhinged quality of her talks is exactly what makes them so powerful. Grace subscribes to old-school Christian standards of femininity. She cooks for her family 5 nights a week, prays over every meal, and painstakingly compiles at least 3 scrapbooks per year to commemorate Christmas, summer vacation, and the twins' birthday. Born 2 months premature when Grace was 48, a miracle that never ceases to amaze her. After our interview, she urged me, "Get back to your babies." Her burning hatred for crime is easily mistaken for tough-on-crime politics, a dangerous movement that has ruined our juvenile justice system, drained taxes, disproportionately affected people of color, and studies have shown raised recidivism rates. But Grace is not a politician. She rallies for no cause other than emotional ventilation. At her CrimeCon book signing, where an endless queue of women clutched copies of Nancy Grace's book, Don't Be a Victim, I met several survivors, including Ashley and her wife, Kimberly, together 17 years. Kimberly had helped Ashley overcome the psychological scarring of child abuse. As lesbians, they were unbothered by Grace's right-leaning politics, because what mattered to them more was that she screamed herself hoarse on behalf of victims, just as she once had in Atlanta, back when a male attorney called Grace an embarrassment to female prosecutors because she dared advocate for murdered women from a place of emotion. Ashley compared her to Olivia Benson, the fictional heroine on Law and Order SVU. As a child, Ashley had fantasized that Benson might save her. Today, Grace preaches to a different sort of jury, telling brutal true stories about dead women to massive audiences of women who statistically have likely been victimized themselves. And in that sense, although Grace might take issue with this characterization, given the loathsome politicization of the term, she is a feminist. In a way, she embodies CrimeCon's feminine id, the unfiltered voice of 4,000 women's collective rage and sorrow. As the unending line of Grace acolytes inched closer to their patron saint of trauma, a crying woman, Dornette Mullings, stepped from the front. She had flown to Orlando with a stack of flyers, bearing the face of her twin, Calvin. According to Mullings, he died under suspicious circumstances that the local police seemed intent to ignore. Grace sat quietly at her folding table, listening to Mulling's story that Dornette had traveled to CrimeCon to beg Grace to cover Calvin's case on her podcast tugged at Grace's heartstrings. That the two had been twins brought Grace to tears. "We will do it," she assured Mullings, promising to highlight Calvin's story. "We will do it immediately." Mullings sobbed with sheer relief. Later, she texted me that CrimeCon had been the therapy I needed. In 2 days, I got so much support from people who understood my emotions and my thoughts, Mullings texted. Even though the focus was on crime, there was an opportunity for grieving and healing for me. On the final day of CrimeCon, I visited Expo Hall. True crime-related booths filled the space. Some repped podcasts, hawking free stickers, while others were manned by small businesses, marking items ranging from dolls to self-defense weapons, disguised as women's handbags, hairspray canisters, and lipstick. Nearby stood a female mannequin wearing a gown of crime scene tape, her black and yellow skirt fluttering gently in the breeze from an air conditioning unit. Outside the grand ballroom, I bid goodbye to Molly and Kirsten. They'd spent just enough time at CrimeCon to get all the autographs they wanted, and next on their honeymoon was Tampa, followed by an Airbnb on the Gulf, where they hoped to see some manatees, Kirsten's favorite animal. As attendees wheeled suitcases past emptying event spaces, I found Stacy and Natalia at the Marriott bar, immersed in casual conversation with a fellow crime junkie and her dog photos. "We're conducting our own interview," Stacy joked, gesturing to the stranger, Ashley, who incidentally owned 7 dogs and was currently at odds with the bartender over service of more mimosas. After coaxing him into pouring a beer, Ashley shared with us that she had escaped an abusive relationship at age 19, shortly after having her first child. As a survivor, she felt activated by true stories of domestic violence. Gabby Petito's infamous traffic stop, in particular, had enraged her, especially when people insinuated online that Gabby should have been tougher or more vocal with police, who had handled the entire situation atrociously. In fact, being tougher or strong-headed, as Ashley described her younger self, just makes it, the abuse, worse. According to research, standing up to one's oppressor can prove deadly to a woman suffering intimate partner violence. The most dangerous moment is when a woman tries to leave. Alternatively, a lack of support from law enforcement can also foster a kill or be killed mindset, driving some victims to murder their abusers. "Because that's what happens if you're a tough woman," Natalia commiserated. "You're probably going to end up being the one in trouble the rest of your life." During her own abusive marriage, one of Natalia's biggest anxieties had been the possibility of accidentally killing her husband in self-defense. Hence, her fascination with Snapped, a true crime series that profiles women accused or convicted of murder, focusing on the violence that made them snap. "Not that I would do it," she emphasized, yet she related to the despair of seeing no other way out. Natalia had wed at the tender age of 20 after courting a close friend under the watchful eye of a chaperone. "Everything was by the Bible," she said, describing the community of Jehovah's Witnesses in which she'd been raised. "Once we married, everything changed. He was a completely different person." Natalia says she appealed to church elders, who warned that leaving her husband would result in excommunication. She did it, anyway. After the divorce, Natalia lost everything, her friends, her family, her spirituality, and completely started over on her own. Then she met Stacy, who had been raised Mormon. They related to each other's experience of being black sheep in high-demand religions. And there were darker shared experiences, too. Outside the church, they had both suffered abuse at the hands of men. Clearly rattled by the memory, Stacy said to me, "I don't think I want to go back to that room." Chiding herself, she added, "I didn't even mean to talk about it." When asked what feelings arose when she tried to talk about it, Stacy hesitated before answering on behalf of herself, Natalia, Ashley, and perhaps all women embroiled in intimate partner violence. "I think the unfortunate thing is that we feel shame. We feel like somehow we had something to do with it." Even now, she was hardest on herself, contemplating, "What could I have done better? How did I put myself in that position?" "And also how they talked to you later after the fact," Stacy added. Because then, after the abuse, he says, it didn't happen the way that you thought it happened. And then you question yourself, and what you really saw or felt is just a spiral. She trailed off, unwilling to go further, explaining that even remembering the abuse made her red. Nobody understood that fire like Natalia, with whom Stacy had so much in common. Shortly after their meeting, Stacy recalled finding herself alone in a parking garage, when, all at once, the enormity of that face-reddening abuse washed over her and she felt her knees buckle. The next thing she knew, she was sitting on the cold concrete floor with her back against the tire of somebody else's car, crying uncontrollably. And despite not really knowing her that well, Stacy instinctively phoned Natalia, who showed up in what felt like 0 seconds and held Stacy in her arms for an eternity. And then, sometime later, they binged the entire Casey Anthony trial, and everything started to feel better somehow. It was a friendship forged in violence, empathy, and healing, one that carried them to CrimeCon, where the last recorded song to play over the intercom before Creighton Waters' band took the stage had been I Will Survive. Before leaving for the airport, I wandered the CrimeCon gift shop, passing up branded travel mugs and cheeky crop tops, I'm only here for an alibi, for a tote stamped with I Know Things in groovy pink lettering. For whatever reason, the bag called to me, but I ended up putting it back. Too much of a conversation starter. Strange men no longer tried to rape me, but they still got in my way, subjecting me to lectures and other unwanted advances unimaginable to any man. Just that weekend, an Uber driver tried to buckle my seatbelt. A male Marriott staffer forced me to guess 3 times the cost of my ramen noodles before agreeing to sell them to me at a discount, pressuring me to thank him. The next man I encountered cornered me at 1 a.m. to preach about his love of Marriott Bonvoy travel points before asking me whether I had children. I did not wish to increase the likelihood of such encounters by wearing I Know Things over one shoulder, inevitably prompting someone bearded to smirk, "So, what things do you know?" At which point I would need to respond, and who knew how long the stupid back and forth would last, all to preserve his fragile ego, because regardless of a woman's age, you just never know who's going to kill you. But I'm alive, and I am lucky. As I write this, countless people, some of them only children, are being subjected to sex trafficking and enslavement, among other horrors. 89,000 women and girls were murdered around the globe in 2022, one of the most violent years on record. People like the Afghan activist I recently met, who told me she can never return home or the Taliban will kill her. Or Keisha Jacobs, who went missing 7 years ago, prompting her mother, Toni, to attend last year's CrimeCon to raise awareness. Toni learned a few weeks before this story was published that Keisha was murdered. The vast majority of these stories are never heard. Later, I thought of the women of CrimeCon as I boarded my flight home. I was planning to write this story on the plane, but as I took my seat, my brain blitzed, short-circuited by all those traumas. And so, to clear my head, I did what many women do. I switched on a violent crime show about a victim I'd never met. She'd been abducted to replace another woman who had herself been abducted to replace the one before her, and so on, like Russian dolls, each one killed and tossed aside like garbage when she could not satisfy their captors' sick fantasies, until finally, the newest woman in the chain murdered their jailer on every woman's behalf, breaking the cycle, and it relaxed me to go into this dark place where all my troubles felt light in comparison. My mind could finally start working. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.